evening. Welcome to Left to Right and Center. We have a very special program tonight. On the show, a global townhouse with some of the finest minds on the new COVID variant, including my colleague Sonia's exclusive interview with Dr. Angelique Kutzer, the South African doctor who raised the Omicron alert. Her views are important. She says that there are indicators that this strain results in mild infection, but it's early days yet to reach any conclusion. The world is, however, clearly not taking any chances whatsoever. Countries are now shutting down international air travel, even as evidence indicates that Omicron has already spread far and wide. This is our panel on this program tonight. The big question is this: is Omicron here in India as yet? We don't know just yet. Well, just a little while back, my colleague Sonia Singh spoke to Dr. Angelique Kutzer. She is the chairperson of the South African Medical Association, a South African doctor who first raised the alarm over Omicron. Listen in to what she said and what she is dealing with in her patients.
I'm joined by Dr. Angelique Kutzer. She's a physician in South Africa and also chairperson of the South African Medical Association. But of course, also the doctor who first raised the alert over the Omicron variant. Dr. Kutzer, thank you very much for joining me this evening on NDTV. I just wanted to ask that you actually have had first-hand experience of seeing patients with Omicron. Tell us about how you first spotted this and what you identified as the symptoms.
Good afternoon, and maybe it's good evening at your side. Yes. Yeah, so I think it's important to understand that when we first now starting to see these patients, it's mild symptoms. It's not the same symptoms than you normally will see with the Delta variant. Mm-hmm. What we call mild symptoms is like fatigue. Sort of a scratchy throat. It's not really a sore throat. Nothing with the nose really going on. They're not complaining any of with stuffy noses. What we call body aches and pains and a bit of a headache. Mm-hmm. So that would also fall under the term, a medical term, malaise. That's and not really having a temperature. I've seen about two children with a temperature. Mm-hmm. But it's mild symptoms and totally different from your COVID, your Delta variant. And I think what is important to understand, when we say this is mild symptoms, we're not saying you don't need to go to the doctor. We're actually encouraging you to go and see your healthcare worker to make sure that these symptoms that you think is actually not of any importance might be the Omicron already been there, and you might spread that variant mm-hmm. to other people who is unvaccinated and cannot afford it. So when we say it's mild, yes, we are saying, please don't be at this stage too alarmed that everyone is going to die from this variant. But also don't just think this type of infection I have will just get better on its own. Right. Please go and make sure. That's the reason why we keep on saying it's mild symptoms as well. One of the reasons.
And Dr. Kutzer, because as you said this, the World Health Organization today issued a statement warning that consequences, the worries of transmission of the Omicron virus could be very severe if we let it go uncontrolled. This comes, of course, when we're seeing country after country imposing very severe test travel restrictions, especially against South Africa. Do you think that's really the right response? And actually the data coming out of South Africa is what has worried people in India as well, that in some provinces, the Delta variant is being replaced by the Omicron variant in a very short span of time. So the transmissibility, even though mild, seems very high.
Yes. We're not disputing the transmissibility. We think it is for now it's difficult for me, that's a clinician, to say it's worse than the Delta variant, but it's just as transmissible than the Delta variant, at this stage of the game. The scientists will tell you it might be more, and that's fine. The fact it is transmissible, and it's more than the Beta variant was before. So the severity of the disease, it depends on, and I think this is where the whole confusion or the whole hype is coming in, because of the 30 odd mutations it's got. People don't know what to do with this virus. They don't know what's going to happen going forward. And we can only say to you what we are currently experiencing. And so within the next 2 weeks from now on, we will know with the data that we would then have, is it escaping the vaccines? Mm-hmm. Is it escaping our acquired immune, and do you see only breakthrough infections not really escaping the vaccines? Or people who have been previously infected, what is the reinfection rate? And if he's reinfected, how bad clinically these patients would be? So in the end of the day, it goes about how severely affected people are who would be in need of hospitalization. So the mere fact that we say it's a mild disease doesn't take it away that you're not going to feel sick. You are going to feel sick. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be very much self-limiting, after you have told the patient what to do and you assist the patient.
Right.
But for now, we don't see that there's oxygen needs or ICU needs. It's not there yet on the patients, type of patients that we encounter at the primary care level. I'm not talking about patients lying in hospital, mm-hmm. and whether they are already being sorted as whether it's Delta or Omicron. That's hospital level. But we also haven't seen an increase in hospitalization.
So that's a very encouraging sign. You're saying that right now, and of course you chair the South African Medical Association, that at the primary healthcare level, and even in the rate of hospitalization, you're not seeing a surge similar to the surge we're seeing of cases. So hopefully that may be a silver lining.
That might. And it might stay like this. And it might change within the next 48 hours.
Right.
But that is the type of virus that we're working with. And so we're just saying to the world out there, listen, yes, we know we see these people. We know our infectivity rate is going up. But let's take one step back and let us just see what is going to happen mm-hmm. before everyone go into a hype, closing borders, affecting other people's lives. And we still haven't worked this out. And it's not a South African disease. It's a world over disease. I'm quite sure it's in other countries as well. And we have already seen reports coming from other countries that it's there.
Yes.
So... but because South Africa spoke up and told the world what we are seeing, and then again on clinical level at primary healthcare, we're saying, guys, what we are currently seeing is not in relationship with the hype. We're not saying it's not going to change.
There's a very real worry that there could be chaos when the new travel regulations come into effect from the 1st of December. Let me explain why. Now, what you're going to see over here, this explainer, pertains primarily to travelers who come to India from countries designated at risk. Now, these are the countries: European nations, including the UK, South Africa, Brazil, Bangladesh, Botswana, China, Mauritius, New Zealand, Zimbabwe, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Israel. America missing over there. So let's talk about these countries. Before you arrive, you have to fill and upload both a self-declaration form and a negative RT-PCR test result on the Air Suvidha portal. Once you arrive, you do an RT-PCR test on arrival and cannot exit the airport till your report comes. That could take several hours. What happens next? If you are negative and are allowed to exit the airport, you go into home quarantine for a period of 7 days. You then do a retest RT-PCR on day 8. If you test positive on day 8, then it is strict isolation and genomic tests to identify Omicron. On the other hand, if you test positive at the airport itself upon arrival, your sample is immediately sent for genomic sequencing. You are admitted into an isolation facility from the airport itself. If you are identified with Omicron, once your genetic sequencing comes back, then there is very strict isolation until you get better, a doctor decides. But the bottom line is this. It is absolutely critical for our airports to have the facilities in place to ensure thousands of passengers are efficiently tested and social distancing is maintained. And finally, if you are not from an at-risk nation, you're free to leave. But 5% of travelers may be random tested as well. So where exactly is India in terms of preparedness? What exactly is our own thinking in India as far as Omicron is concerned? We've got Dr. Sabinath Panda, the head of epidemiology and communicable diseases at the Indian Council of Medical Research with us. We're also joined by Professor Ravindra Gupta, professor of clinical microbiology at Cambridge University. Thank you both very much for being with us. Dr. Panda, let me come to you first. Do we have reason to believe at this juncture that Omicron may already be here in India?
Yes, of course. There is a possibility because of the high transmissibility of this particular variant, Omicron. And the first detection happened in South Africa on 9th of this month, November. And then it was reported on 21st, and then 24th was the announcement. So during that time, there have been many travels happening from South Africa and Benin. So I would say that I would be surprised, and there are asymptomatic cases as well. So one would not be surprised if that detection happens within India. It's just a matter of time, given the high transmissibility that this variant comes with.
Dr. Panda, we've seen, for example, in Maharashtra, an old age home where there were 67 people who've tested positive, 62 of them were double vaccinated. Is this something that you're going to be looking at very closely to see if this is Omicron?
Of course. I mean, INSACOG is the platform. So in that sense, I would say that India is quite well prepared because we have now the INSACOG facility with laboratories spread all over India. And they are quite adept in quickly sequencing the samples in terms of identifying the variant which is responsible for a particular infection. Now, we must remember here that vaccination does not prevent acquisition of the infection. So even if there has been double vaccination, only two doses of the vaccine, we have now Covaxin and Covishield, both are intramuscular injections and given in two doses. But that does not prevent acquisition of infection. So if the COVID-appropriate behavior is not observed, one can always get, infected. And the way one should prevent it is by use of mask, maintaining hand hygiene, avoiding mass gathering, all the possibilities that could actually transmit infection. So vaccination might, help in reducing the fear from the disease or the necessity for hospitalization or requirement of oxygenation or in preventing death. But acquisition of infection is not prevented by vaccination.
Dr. Panda, isn't it time we start talking about booster doses, particularly since we've got a glut of vaccines presently available? There are so many people, senior citizens, even others, who've had their second dose several months back. I'm not a senior citizen just yet, but I had my second dose more than 6 months back. And I'd like a booster dose at some stage. I'm sure others would as well. If we have the vaccines, people who haven't taken their second dose are not suffering because they'll get it when they choose to get it. Then why shouldn't those who want a third dose get theirs?
There are two sides to this question. One is what is happening or what happens at the population level. So if you ask me, what is the necessity or the priority in terms of the public health, I would say that the large proportion of people, get covered under two doses of vaccination, that's the best and that should be the public health priority. But at the individual level, of course, a person who is not able to mount, a sufficient immunity or is suffering from immunosuppressive conditions or is not able to, generate enough protection post-infection and also post-vaccination. Of course, that's a group of people or individuals who need to be considered.
But Dr. Panda, yes or no, should we not start as soon as possible booster doses for those who are eligible, right?
Yes. And then at the population level, the attention should not be diverted because then there will be a great deal of problem in terms of new variants coming in and even the old variants and causing, the burden on the healthcare system. If those who need to be covered with the vaccines are not covered and therefore land up in the advanced stage of the disease and the burden on the healthcare system would be huge.
Yep.
So our attention from this public health priority should not get diverted.
Yeah. Professor Gupta, in the United Kingdom, there has been a policy for the last several months where masks were not required. People were said that, were told that, you know, take off your masks, you'll be all right. And you've done this in the United Kingdom despite the fact that the numbers have always been reasonably high. But with more vaccines, the number of fatalities have been considerably low. But now the United Kingdom is back to encouraging masks in public transportation and I believe in closed spaces as well. Is this because you believe that Omicron is way more dangerous than Delta in terms of transmissibility?
Thank you. Well, I think that the removal of masking was certainly not something that scientists in the UK supported, mainly because we had high rates of infection at the time. We had good vaccine coverage. We did not have excellent vaccine coverage. It was only around sort of 70%. And of course, we were not vaccinating children. And since then, we've seen huge surges of cases in children and some severe illness and some deaths. So it has not been without cost. And many of us have been campaigning on and speaking out, saying that it is essential that people are wearing face masks as a symbol that the problem is not over, but also to limit transmission in public transport, public places, and even in other settings. So, you know, the reintroduction of masks really has come at a time coincident with Omicron, but actually there was a case for it for the last few months in any case. And I don't think really, in my eyes, that this is necessarily just a direct response to the new variant.
Professor Gupta, from the limited studies which anybody would have done at this stage, the data is still coming in. What is the R naught or the factor by which Omicron replicates vis-a-vis the original wild strain of COVID and Delta subsequently, to your understanding now?
I think it's really far too early to estimate that at the moment. It's really it would be a very inaccurate estimate if we were to conjure up a number. I think the most important thing is that this is a variant that clearly has a good level of transmissibility in the community. It has gone unnoticed in many places, and that it carries a mutational profile that is really remarkably different to what we've seen before, and with mutations in many places that are key for the immune system's ability to neutralize the virus, but also areas that may enhance the transmissibility of the virus. So we really should be cautious if we can, without necessarily being overreactive.
Dr. Panda, I don't know if you had a chance to see what Dr. Amanda Kutzer said on this program, in fact, just a little while back, to my colleague Sonia Singh. She raised the alarm internationally as far as Omicron was concerned. But she's also a clinical, she's a clinician. She deals with these cases on a constant basis. And whatever she's seen is indicative of a mild infection and an infection which ultimately ends at a certain stage. It doesn't progress beyond a certain point. Are you encouraged by what she says? Because at one level, it seems to contradict the physical structure of this new virus, which, I mean, it's got so many mutations that it seems to be potentially far more lethal.
All right. So the structural changes, the genomic variations that actually infer a name for a new, you know, mutant for a variant, that might, you know, impart transmissibility to the variant or to the mutant, which could also give them a possibility or an ability to escape the immunity generated post-infection or post-vaccination. But that does not necessarily go hand in hand with increased fatality. So the transmissibility is not synonymous or doesn't go in tandem with fatality. That's one. So I'm not surprised by what Dr. Angelic said. And the increase, the percentage increase within a very narrow period of time that was observed on the graph that you are showing now on the screen, clearly says that the variant has very high transmissibility. But then, as I said, who these mutants are infecting and what is the clinical course happening in them is the issue that we are discussing. So if somebody who is elderly and who has associated comorbidity, one might expect, and there are reports of severe form of the disease. But then again, the age group which is being infected with this highly transmissible virus, And their illness might be like mine, as was reported and was being shared by Dr. Angeli. That's important to remember.
Absolutely. I'd like to thank both of you very much for joining us. This is a global town hall. We've got experts from around the world who are actually joining us on this program. But a couple of questions which have come in on Ku. Geet has come in with this question. The Omicron variant carries a very high global risk of surges, the World Health Organization has warned, as more countries reported cases. What should be our priority? Well, that's what we're trying to get to the bottom of. Shreya says the time has come to take a decision on a booster dose immediately. So a couple of opinions over there. Earlier on the day, I spoke to one of India's finest experts as far as infectious diseases is concerned. Dr. Gagandeep Kang is professor at the Christian Medical College in Vellore. She's also co-author of a book, Till We Win, India's Fight Against the COVID-19 Pandemic. Here she delves deeply into the preliminary learning that we have around the world on Omicron and what it potentially means. Thank you, ma'am, very much for being with us. Now, the World Health Organization, in its latest risk assessment, says, and I quote, given mutations that may confer immune escape potential and possibly greater transmissibility advantage, the likelihood of potential further spread of Omicron at the global level is high. Why is that the case, ma'am? What is it specifically about this variant that concerns us?
Well, this variant has more mutations than any other variant that we've seen in the past. And the fact that it has arisen with all of these mutations makes us wonder what we missed on the path to this variant. Was this something that was evolving in Africa and we just didn't pick it up until it wound up in Botswana and South Africa? Or is this something that came from an immunocompromised person that was unable to suppress replication of the virus, where the virus replicated for a long time against an inadequate immune response and wound up getting lots and lots of mutations? Whatever it is, the mutations are several and they are located in regions of the surface of the virus that are responsible for the binding of the virus and also at places where antibodies bind. Further than that, there are also mutations in areas where we know that T cells respond to the virus. Now, there are hundreds of regions where T cells bind, and the mutations so far on modeling are in half a dozen places. But all of this taken together is very concerning, because we have clearly greater transmissibility and potentially immune escape.
So Dr. Kang, again, I'll just introduce a bunch of questions which people are asking, and do share your answers with us. Firstly, when we talk about transmissibility, how much more transmissible is the new COVID variant? I realize the information is preliminary.
Yeah. So if we look at R-naughts of viruses, we said that the ancestral Wuhan variant had an R-naught of somewhere around 2.5, and Delta is estimated to be somewhere between 6.5 and 8. And there have been estimations that have been made for this variant that say that it might potentially be several times Delta. I think that that is unlikely to be the case, but it does seem like this is a very transmissible variant. Just as an example, measles has an R-naught of about 15 and is the most infectious virus we know. So somewhere between 8 and 15, if it's greater than 15, then it's going to be a virus that's going to infect practically everybody it comes in contact with.
Doctor, when we speak about R-naught, I think it's important to understand this. When you say a transmissibility factor of, say, 8, it means for every one person who gets it, there is a possibility of 8 more being infected. Is that broadly correct?
It's broadly correct if everyone is susceptible. But fortunately for us, we are in a situation where everyone is no longer susceptible.
Because of the
vaccine. And in India, because of vaccine and prior infection. So in India, we may have a small advantage, because a lot of our people were infected before they were vaccinated. And we know that the combination of vaccination and infection gives you the broadest possible immune response. So we may be lucky there.
But Dr. Kang, what we are reading now is that people who've been double vaccinated or even triple vaccinated are still contracting this.
Yes, it's a proportion of people who, in whom we have data, who had received two or three doses of vaccine. And I'm not that worried about people who have been vaccinated getting infected. The question is, that's important for transmission, obviously, and for the spread of the virus. But in terms of disease, are the people who are vaccinated doubly or triply, are they getting sick with the virus? And so far, the data that we have from those individuals in whom we have a history of vaccination, it seems like they were either asymptomatic or mild infections.
Yeah.
But this is something that we need to watch for.
Which actually brings me to my next question. Does greater transmissibility mean greater severity of COVID?
Not necessarily. Some of the most transmissible viruses that we have do not cause severe disease. So if we are lucky, this may wind up being a very transmissible agent, but not one that results in severe disease. So for example, I'll refer you back to H1N1. Very transmissible virus, but fortunately for us, not as severe disease as many other influenza viruses.
Professor Kang, I just want to go back to the point that you were talking about R0 or the R factor, the rate of replication of a particular virus. In a group which is perhaps single vaccinated or not vaccinated at all, if you have something more with an R0 of 15 and above, as may be the case with this new variant, it actually means that if you are not protected in some form, if you've not had COVID before, you haven't had vaccines, one person who gets it could actually share it to 15 plus people who have also been unprotected, right? And therefore, the number multiplies exponentially. That is the worry, right? And the reason I ask this is because I just want to reaffirm the importance of vaccination.
No, you know, in principle, you have it absolutely right. But I will point out that it doesn't matter. We don't know that it is 15 at the moment.
Right.
We know that Delta is between 6.5 and 8. So let's take Delta. Even with Delta, in that situation of everybody being susceptible around one person who is infected, yes, it winds up being exponential spread. But what we do have to remember is that the world is no longer in a situation where everybody that surrounds an infected person is going to be completely susceptible, unvaccinated, uninfected.
Right. Dr. Kang, next question. Will the vaccines work on the new COVID variant?
We don't know is the short answer. And there are approaches that are already being taken by scientists in, I know for sure, the US and in South Africa, where one, they are developing pseudoviruses that will allow us to very rapidly test for whether antibodies that have been generated in response to vaccines can neutralize the virus or not. There are similar approaches being taken at the African Health Research Institute, where they are doing the same kinds of assays with the live virus. Now, that's a much slower process, but gives you much clearer answers than using pseudoviruses does. So everybody is scrambling to figure out which vaccines are going to work best against the virus. But the important thing for people to remember is that we actually, if we need to, we can make vaccines quite quickly now, which puts us in a very different situation from where we were last year.
And therefore, the importance of modified vaccines. We don't talk about that. We talk only about the main vaccines, but we've already seen Delta. We don't have a dedicated variant of a vaccine against Delta. And this has just happened now. Why aren't we talking about modified vaccines?
Well, actually, the variant that was able to escape the immune response the most was the Beta variant, and both Pfizer and Moderna did develop vaccines against the Beta variant using the Beta sequence. And they did clinical trials immunizing people with the Beta variant. And what they found was that it was an incremental advantage. So if you gave people a third shot of the old version of the vaccine, or you gave them a third shot, which was Beta, on the back of two shots of the original version of the vaccine, there was a very tiny incremental advantage against Beta in the people that had received the Beta booster. And even the people that had received the third dose of the older version of the vaccine, their immune response broadened as well. That's why they did not pursue a regulatory pathway for the Beta variant. Now, with this variant, which has many more mutations than the Beta variant, will that be necessary or not? We'll have to wait and see.
Well, it's time now for us to take a short break. There's a lot more coming up, including more experts. Dr. N.K. Arora, somebody who's in charge of the National Mission for Vaccination, joins us, along with several others. That's coming up in the next few minutes. Welcome back. We're going to go back to our panel of doctors and experts in just a few moments. But there's another very important aspect to the curbs and the new regulations which India has put in place, like so many other countries. And that is with regard to international travelers coming into our country. Joining us now, Vinamra Longani. He's an aviation analyst and author. To give us an idea of the potential chaos which we may see in Delhi Airport and in the other big airports, because there are thousands of passengers from at-risk countries, more than 14 nations, who would arrive, and they would all need to get, all passengers would need to get RT-PCR tests and those results before they can even leave the airport. So, Mr. Longani, does India have this sort of infrastructure to deal with the numbers which we'll be seeing from the 1st of December?
So thank you for having me on the show, Vishnu. Always a pleasure to be on NDTV. Now, I'll start with my example. You know, I got off an Emirates flight a couple of weeks ago when I landed. And at that point in time, if you came from the UAE, you were required to take a test on arrival. Now, this is firsthand experience. Got off the plane. There were about 10 desks set up there. I had paid for my test in advance, much like pretty much everybody else on the plane, which is what I was told. This was a full flight which came in from Dubai, and the process took hardly any time. I mean, within a matter of minutes, the testing was done. And the difference being, we could give our swab at that point in time, and we didn't have to wait at the airport. You know, you gave a swab and you got your report over WhatsApp or email a couple of hours later. Now, the real issue in my mind is, even if we can manage, you know, to have enough staff, you know, medical staff and nurses to be able to conduct the tests, the real issue is, how do you socially, physically distance thousands of passengers who just arrived, you know, from Europe or wherever it is at this airport? Now, airports essentially were never sort of, you know, designed to be it, wherein, you know, people could be socially distanced. So in my opinion, that is the real issue. I mean, I tweeted about this and I guess you read it too, because you had retweeted it further. There will be about 1,200 passengers who will get off four different flights from Europe within 3 hours of these rules sort of, you know, being applicable. Now, in my mind, socially distancing 1,200 people in the arrival area, which is not set up for something like this, was never designed for something like this, is going to be an issue. So that in my opinion is going to be the challenge, managing that situation.
You know, you make a very important point, because if I'm just going through the numbers which we managed to get hold of on the 1st of December, just before the 1st of December at 11:20 p.m. there's a flight from France which comes in, an A350 to Delhi. There's a flight, a Virgin flight, which comes in at 2 a.m. There's an Air India flight which comes in at 3 a.m. So three flights right over there before the next flight, which is a few hours later, right? Quite a few hours later. So it's packed at Delhi Airport, and people are going to be in close proximity to each other, waiting for several hours before their RT-PCR test result comes. That is the biggest problem.
Absolutely. I mean, let me just start off by saying everybody getting in on that Air France flight is going to be lucky because they get in before midnight. So they don't have to worry about these new guidelines, but because they kick in at 00:00 or 00:00 hours on the 1st of December. So they would be spared this, but everybody else.
Assuming their flight is on time. Yeah.
One would really hope that flight's on time. And you know, the authorities, should it be delayed, consider the arrival, consider the scheduled arrival time. But coming back to your point, you know, yes, that in my mind is the biggest concern. These people would have been on the flight for 8 or 9 hours. And then, you know, before an international flight anyway, you know, your journey starts way before. You've got to check in a couple of hours before. COVID doesn't make it easy, to sort of like, you know, these protocols that have got to be followed. And I mean, just, I'm sorry to digress, but this is an industry view, you know. I mean, I don't speak for everybody, but as an analyst, over the last 18 months or so, I think the aviation industry has been the hardest hit. And, you know, this industry, be it the airports or the airlines, you know, some of the most stringent sort of COVID protocols, this industry
has
been subjected to.
Perhaps in the present situation, Vinamra, those might be required, but will they be effective enough, I think, is the question. Thank you so much for coming in, sharing those views with us. I need to quickly move on now. We are joined by Dr. N.K. Arora. He is the COVID panel chief, somebody who has really led India's efforts as far as vaccination is concerned. Dr. Arora, thanks very much for being with us. My first question to you, as we prepare for Omicron, and you know it might come into our country if it's not already here, it seems an inevitability, given its spread in so many parts of the world, should we not prioritize a booster dose, particularly to those who are vulnerable, and particularly since we have enough vaccines presently available?
So the first key question is that when a new variant comes, what is the relationship between the variant and the effectiveness of the current vaccines on that particular variant? That is a very important component. And fortunately, so far, whatever experience is, globally about 20 to 25 vaccines are in use, out of which about 10 are emergency use listed by WHO. They have variable effectiveness for symptomatic disease varying between 50% to 90-92%. But fortunately, all of them provide 90 to 95% protection against serious disease.
Right.
Now, this is a very important and a kind of a redeeming point of the current vaccines. The second point is that when a new virus has come, how do we react? Should it be a panic reaction? Because for us, booster means 94 crore doses.
Yes.
It is not, and which itself is not something which can be done overnight. So it has to be done based on science, our own epidemiology, and the value of this action. And so we are waiting for next at least 2 weeks or so when labs across the country, including some of our own labs, are working on the effectiveness of immune response elicited by current vaccines, our own vaccines, Covaxin, Covishield, and the other vaccines in other part of the world, with the virus, and to what extent the virus neutralization takes place. So unless that information is there, I think saying other things will be hypothetical, to say
no,
the least.
No, but Dr. Arora, this is an important point.
Let me complete. So the most important and the most effective tool at this time for us is that we should complete priority immunization at the highest priority level and at speed. And because still about 12 to 15 crore people in India haven't received even a single dose, and another 30 crores or so have not received their second dose.
But Dr. Arora, this is the point I don't understand. I fully understand that people must get their second dose. No question about it. The fact that it's not happening fast enough is a national problem. We all accept that. There are still vaccines which are available. It's been reported in across our big cities, vaccine availability. If there is a senior citizen who has got their vaccine more than 6 months back or 6 months back, it is waning the efficacy. Based on what we have seen all over the world, AstraZeneca, Covishield is used all over the world. Why shouldn't they go, if necessary, pay for it and get another dose? Unless it's medically counter-instructive, which is not the case at all.
So let me go to the, I used the word local epidemiology. And what is our own experience? So what is true for Israel, for Europe or North America may not be truly applicable here. Our epidemiology shows two things. One is almost 100 crore doses have been given after the second wave waned off, most of the impact. So after June 21st, we have given about 100 crore doses. So most of our people have received the vaccine after the wave was over. Simultaneously, we are seeing that at that time, when the second wave was on its wane, 67% people were showing evidence of infection, natural infection. More recent data in October is showing that 80-85% people, children particularly, are showing infection, which means natural infection because adults have also received vaccine. So a very large proportion of our population has already contracted infection, and on top of that, they have got the vaccine. So that is one piece of evidence. The second evidence is that we have got a vaccine tracker, national vaccine tracker platform. ICMR is managing, and we are seeing that the number of cases are declining despite festivals and other things, and whereas vaccination is going. And that is, everybody knows about it. So we have seen the breakthrough infections have not increased in all categories of individuals, elderly as well as those who have received the vaccines in early part of this year. So we are going exactly by the scientific evidence. As you rightly said, vaccine security or vaccines availability is not an issue at all. We have plenty of vaccines, and that is not. The second thing is, I think there is certain degree of misinformation. One is that private sector, some hospitals have vaccines available, and this is a couple of million doses. But private government sector has not even a single vaccine has been wasted due to expiry of date. This I can assure the whole country that not even a single dose. In fact, our record is really worth appreciating because normally 5 to 10% vaccine wastage is kind of acceptable in such a major program. Our vaccine wastage is less than 3%. So we have done pretty well, and we are not wasting even a single. It's a very invaluable commodity, and we would not like to do that. And third thing is that we are coming up very soon, in next week or 2 weeks' time, a comprehensive policy regarding giving additional dose to those who are likely to be immunocompromised. And we have to differentiate this from booster. What is additional dose? Additional dose is, and you give on after primary extra dose to those people who are likely to be immunocompromised or immunosuppressed for any reason. So we are coming up, and along with that, we are also coming up with a comprehensive policy on pediatric immunization, because that is another concern. How do we proceed? And we are moving in that direction. And we have a very rich pipeline for pediatric immunization.
So, Dr. Arora, that's what I wanted to ask you about. And just before I ask you about the pediatric rollout, those immunocompromised and who have got two doses of vaccines already, you are saying that they will get another dose. It's a question of when, right? Is that what you just said?
Yeah, we are coming up with a comprehensive policy the way we want to move in this direction. We have an NTAGI meeting, which is to take a final call on that.
Okay, that's question one. Question two, before I get to the pediatric rollout, how optimistic are you about the rollout of anti-COVID pills, whether it's Merck or Pfizer. Merck's numbers have come down in terms of efficacy. On the other hand, India has got remarkable ability of manufacturing in numbers. So there is Molnupiravir and Paxlovid, Pfizer and Merck. What is their potential in our country, sir?
The potential of these drugs will always be very much there. They are very important drugs. But as you see, when suddenly a new variant comes, how do we handle that? Mm-hmm. And so this has to be seen in the overall context. And as I understand that they have waived off their IP on these two drugs so that they can be manufactured. And in fact, the other day, one of the American friend was saying that Indians will manufacture before the Americans start manufacturing. So we have the capability. I understand some kind of discussions are going on with Indian companies, but that is different from vaccines. But I think in view of what has happened in last 1 week, because of the Omicron variant, how this changes, because those are monoclonals, and how will it work in terms of neutralizing the effect of active infection, that also has to be seen. But certainly when these drugs are manufactured in India, the cost comes down drastically, whatever previous experience we have.
So final question, the rollout, the pediatric rollout, when is it going to start? And what is the protocol of this going to be? Could we, for example, to speed up pediatric rollout, see the vaccination of children in school, in schools? Is that even feasible?
You have heard about Har Ghar Dastak program.
Yes.
Where just like polio, we are moving from house to house and giving vaccines to those who are. So everything, now we can go to the schools and vaccination can be done. But I would request the whole country, the state governments and the private sector schools, that schools must be open. Parents should send their children, because we have a good a cohort of immunized adults. And special efforts have been made that all schools and the staff are immunized. And parents should see that all adults in their families where children are going to school are also immunized, so that children are covered by a ring of protection. Hmm. In addition to that, most of the children are already infected. So they are protected in a way. So that sending a school and opening a school is, we should not delay. I would say it's almost like an emergency. These children are suffering from cognitive and intellectual and physical and all lot of social developmental issues. Coming to the framework, pediatric immunization, we have 44 crore children below 18 years. So a prioritization process is in place, and we will also have those who have comorbidities. List of comorbidities is being prepared. And we will go in a stepwise manner. But ultimately, I think somewhere in the later half of December or first, I think we should be able to start the pediatric vaccination for priority children. And as soon as we finish these, which are 10 to 15%, move on to healthy children.
Okay, but so that's a real headline, sir, and that's important. I want to repeat this to make sure that I'm not wrong. Towards the end of December, you expect the rollout for children in particular categories, immunocompromised, etc., etc. And then what did you say will happen in January, sir?
No. So, we have around 10 to 15% children who have some kind of comorbidity.
Right.
So once they are immunized, then we move on to the healthy children somewhere in the first quarter of next year.
When would you be able to finish this? I understand the variables, but are you targeting the middle of next year to ideally, in an ideal world? Because that Zycovid has three doses, sir. And, you know, in a country like ours where people aren't coming for a second dose, to actually encourage them to come for a third dose is also a factor.
Zycovid is just on the anvil of finishing another trial where only two doses are to be given. So that data will also be used.
So the second dose would have more vaccine in it? As I understand it, because of the applicator, you needed three times, because in each application, you would give only a small amount of the vaccine. So are you suggesting that more vaccine would be given to bring down the number of doses?
Yes. And it is not painful. It is not no discomfort. These are three shots on any skin surface, and a child does not feel, or anybody will not feel. It will be two doses in that case. So that we are waiting for the results of that. But in addition, Covaxin has also finished their trial, and we are expecting by December end, Corbavax also to finish their pediatric trial, which is for 5 to 17.
Dr. Arora, you aren't waiting for the WHO's clearance of Zycovid or Covishield for children. You're going to go ahead and start administering them.
Because at the moment, 99% experience is with mRNA vaccine. Mm-hmm. We don't have mRNA vaccine. The children are being given inactivated vaccine, so Covaxin is there. Children are also being given protein subunit, and Carbavax is a protein subunit. Zycovid D is a unique Indian vaccine, first DNA vaccine in the world. So, and it has been seen, we have seen the data. There are no safety concerns. First, we have to see the rollout process, how it works out, because the number of doses available are also less. So we are moving in a slow process. And as not a slow process, but in a systematic way, so that how and in what kind of a regional framework we will start the Zycovid, because they are providing at the moment 1 crore dose. And 1 crore dose is sufficient only for 33 lakh individuals, be it adults or children. And adults also, children are also for adolescents.
Right. As usual, Dr. Arora, one could keep talking with you for hours. The wealth of information you have and the knowledge which you share on something which affects the billion plus in our country, it's so very important, sir. My own personal takeaway, despite having my second dose 6 months back, I'm going to have to wait for my booster. But your logic.
I must assure you are safe. Nothing is going to happen.
All right. Thank you, sir, and you stay safe as well. Thank you very much for being with us. We are completely out of time on this very special episode of Left, Right and Center, a global town hall where we've had experts from India, as you saw, and around the world on Omicron, what it means, and the way forward from here. From all of us here, goodbye. Mm-hmm.